I love Burn the Haystack because I'm a deep thinker and I like to challenge old traditions to make way for a brighter future. That's also why I chose to get my degree from Avondale University College. With a thriving community of believers, I was able to kickstart my career and grow my faith at the same time. Business, arts, teaching, nursing, or ministry. Called to make a difference? Called to be at Avondale.
Welcome back to Burn the Haystack with Josh and Jesse.
I'm Jesse.
And I'm Josh.
And this is a show all about saving the best and burning the rest.
It absolutely is. And you know what? We have hit that time of year, Jesse.
The time of year where we get Nathan Brown on to talk about the latest book that he's written.
Let's hum some Christmas carols in unison. Come on.
Can you hear the sleigh bells ring-a-ling? Ting-ting-tingling? Anyone?
Do you guys whistle? That's a weird question, but...
Occasionally, yes.
Okay. Do you have a default whistle that you do? Like, is there like a default whistle?
You mean in style or song?
Like, is there like a type of whistle, like... I'm not talking about like whether you put your fingers in your mouth or whether you don't, but like, is there like a tune that you like default whistling to?
No, I think it changes every time I whistle now that I think about it. Now, I'm just thinking about whistling the Sleigh Ride or whatever that song is.
Okay. The one that stuck, that just works for my whistling is the U2 song Love Is Bigger Than Anything In Its Way.
That's...
So obviously that's a relatively recent thing because that's only a year or two old as a song. Yeah. But since I saw them in concert last year, that's one of my go-to songs. And so, that's and it's a good whistler.
Yeah. That's cool.
There's a certain type of song that's a whistle. It's not just any song that you turn up.
Yeah. Well, the reason I asked was because... For me, it's Deck the Halls. For some reason, whenever I have nothing else, I'm always...
That's a good whistling song, you know, now that you do it.
It's a good whistling song, right? You know?
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yes. So whenever I whistle, I'm always in the Christmas mood. So.
That's good. So even in mid-July, in the dark of winter...
In the dark of winter. The light of Christmas shines down upon us.
It's a beautiful thing, which is kind of funny with this book. So I'll take over the interview from here.
Do it. Yep, we can retire early.
just kick back. I've had this idea to write this book for a number of years, but of course you get fired up about Christmas at Christmas time, and there's no point writing something for Christmas once you're at Christmas time. And so I had this idea. I've got to work out how I can write this book feeling Christmassy when it's not Christmas. And I kind of, I'd had the idea for a few years and I was kind of, you know, how do I do this? And I said, I'm just going to have to lock myself up in my house sometime, play Christmas carols and try and, you know, get Christmas fired, you know, maybe, cook some Christmas pudding, you know, whatever you have to do to get Christmassy. So as it happened... I'd got approval from a committee that was supporting my writing of this book earlier in the year. And so I knew I had to get on and get it done. And then Melbourne got locked down with COVID restrictions. And so I was stuck in my house for a while. And I actually said, okay, this is the moment. This is the opportunity. And, so I was home, not going anywhere anytime. And, we even had curfews and all of those kind of crazy things.
Wow.
And so I said, I'm going to write this book. And, my idea for it was a devotional book, 31 days of December. So I said, there's 31 days in July. If I start on the 1st of July, I'll be done by the 31st of July. And so every morning I'd get up early in the dark, light a fire, get kind of Christmassy and, write until that day's writing was done. And, my first reader is always my wife. And so her job was then to have some, my target was to have something for her to read each evening of what I'd worked on that day. And so that was our experience of the first month of Melbourne's heavy duty lockdown in the middle of the year in the dark of winter, and thinking Christmassy thoughts. And so I can recommend that as, you know, that's good for your heart and soul, even amidst the challenges of coronavirus lockdowns and some of those kind of things, that this is a pretty good story to spend your time focusing on when some of the other things you take for granted or might wish you were doing can't happen.
That's probably a real pro of writing something Christmassy but in the Southern Hemisphere, because you could do it in winter here and all the sort of Christmas songs and traditions and stuff in media and all, you know, it's all obviously related around America, so it's all very like wintery based.
So there's a bit of that.
Yeah, that's and that's of course a good pro.
That hasn't got much to do with the actual probable timing of Jesus' birth.
Right.
Which probably the best experts suggest that might have taken place in October, that kind of time of year, which means it wouldn't have been in the dead of winter.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even in Israel, it can often snow in the middle of winter, particularly around Jerusalem and Bethlehem and those places, because it does get cold, and they're pretty high elevation. And so, you know, probably two or three times a year it can snow in those places. And so you wouldn't have shepherds out in the fields watching their flocks when if it's that freezing cold and whatever.
True.
So, you know, that's part of the gap in our tradition of Christmas. But, you know, but certainly the traditions of Christmas are very wintry focused, and, you know, the fire crackling and all of those kind of things. Yeah, that feels kind of homey and Christmassy and all those good things.
Yeah. The whole brand of Christmas, like, there's definitely something very warm and comforting and, you know, sort of homely, even without, like, sad to say, the religious sort of spiritual implications. But, of course, those add such an extra beautiful layer over it. I've often felt like ripped off living in Australia, New Zealand, because when everybody else is like, you know, drinking their eggnog and sitting around the Yule log, it's like 35 degrees.
Scorching hot.
It's terrible.
That's right.
Yeah.
And everybody still tries to make a roast dinner.
You're eating hot food. Yeah. Oh, man. The house gets so, so hot when you've got the ovens on. It's, you know, terrible.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, you get a good old Christmas barbecue. That's Christmassy to me, but that's because that's what I've grown up with.
That's the Australian adaptation of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe even the true way, I don't know. But last year, I was in Japan in sort of late November, and I did not, you know, when thinking about Japan, I didn't really think about how they would celebrate Christmas, but they go hard. Like, end of November, they were already, like, there were massive Christmas trees up, and there was a whole Christmas tree, and it was, like, in this shopping center, and it was just a Star Wars-themed Christmas tree. Why? I don't know. Oh, I think the movie was releasing, but I'm like, okay, why not? And it was enormous. I don't even know how tall it was. It was crap, and the decorations were so, like, and this is just at one random shopping center.
Yeah.
Somewhere in Tokyo. Like, everywhere they were going hard. This is end of November. I'm like, man, I want to just stay here for another month. I want to see it hit the climax. I want to see it Christmas Day, but anyway, it was getting pretty cold by that stage.
You wouldn't think that.
Ready to head back.
Were you telling me, Josh, or was it you that was telling me that it's KFC is like a Christmas tradition for Japanese people on Christmas Day? Like it's their sort of like Christmas roast?
I think I was telling you that, but I don't remember now. But I think I remember. This is a long time ago. This is from back then when I came back.
Probably.
I think I mentioned that.
12 months ago. I mean, who remembers what they were doing 12 months ago, to be fair?
There's been a lot between now and 12 months ago. I think we're all probably realizing that.
Hey,
Jesse?
So for the book, so let's get to the book. For those of you who are
booking all this,
for those of you who are watching, Josh and I have our copies here. It is called Advent. I'll get the subtitle: Hearing the Good News in the Story of Jesus' Birth by some guy named Nathan Brown. I'm sure he's fine. I'm sure he's great.
Well, Josh Stuther said so. So who am I to argue?
Well, yes. Like they were telling me in the middle, there is there is a testimonial from this man right underneath me right here, which is
yes. This is why every single Burn the Haystack, every single Haystack burner, all of you need to get this book, because Burn the Haystack has a shout out in it. Okay, it's like right in the very front page.
Well, right, I would like to say Josh endorses it. I don't endorse it. Josh does. So maybe a half endorsement from Burn the Haystack.
It says Burn the Haystack, Jesse. So Burn the Haystack 100% endorses it. Everybody who likes Burn the Haystack endorses this book. Hard out. That's
well
how it
said,
works.
Well said.
If you say so. If you say so.
Jesse, get on board.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I just need to humble myself and get on board. So that's all good. Nathan, tell us about the book. Where did the idea, I mean, you kind of already shared a little bit about where the idea came from, but really, why did you want to write a Christmas themed book in the first place? Did it start like that, or did it start in a different place?
Well, Christmas is one of those things that happens every year. Is that a good place to start?
Yes, I have also noticed that trend.
It's recurring. And it's one of those occasions in our society, even in our very secular societies of Australia and New Zealand and some other such places, even Japan in its own interesting kind of way, that we'll stop and at least acknowledge something to do with the story of Jesus. And it's something we as a church have often recognised that, you know, this is a way, an opportunity for us to talk about Jesus at a time when somebody might be interested in listening. And so it's often been that kind of thing. For myself, Christmas has been a bit of a love-hate relationship. You know, I've gone through that cynical stage that many of us do of, you know, Christmas is just all guff and nonsense and, you know, and there's so much of that, you know, all the, you know, the thing that just really bugs me is the expectation of having to buy gifts for people who don't need anything. You know, and that just drives me batty. And, you know, so when I told my wife that I was working on a book about Christmas, she laughed at me and said, "You're the Christmas grump. You know, why would you ever be writing a story about Christmas?" And the thing is, amidst all the stuff, amidst all, you know, trashy Christmas songs in supermarkets and shopping centres, amidst all, you know, photos with Santa and nonsense that everybody goes on with. So you get to that point, amidst all the craziness and all the pressure and all the family expectations and all the church expectations and all of that stuff, where you just stop and you hear again the story. You sing those songs. You might, you know, watch something that is a story of what actually happened, or whatever it is, where you just stop and realise again the story. And so my, I guess my vision for the book was, how can we stretch those moments across the whole of December? You know, what could we do to, you know, get to somewhere where we can have more of that moment, more of those moments, more of that time across the month leading, you know, the weeks leading up to Christmas. And so Christmas becomes more about that than about all the other stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was my initial vision. The book is 31 chapters, and the idea is a reading for each day of the month of December. And the idea with that is that, you know, you start with something happened, and, you know, this idea of good news that you mentioned in the subtitle. The first part of that is news, something happened. The bigger picture of that is what makes it good. And so that's the rest of the book, is here's all the different aspects of what made that thing that happened so good. And once you get to the 25th reading, that's kind of focused on the actual moment of the birth of Jesus. And then after that, the last week of readings is focused on what happened afterwards, the rest of the story. So Jesus and his teaching, his life and death and resurrection, and his promise for a second advent. And what it means then to live with hope in the light of the story of Jesus and who he was about. So that's the short overview. And that's really what it's designed to do, is to be that, to stretch those moments of realizing how good and amazing and incredible the story of Jesus actually is.
That's cool. I like the idea of that, because I think leading up to Christmas, it often just becomes about just that 25th moment, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then after it, it's like, it's done. You know, like you kind of until forget next year. About it. So I think this is really cool. I think it's a great way to stretch it out and even to go beyond what we normally do when we talk about it.
And of course, there is a tradition in the liturgical calendar of the church of the season of Advent, which is the 4 weeks leading up to Christmas. And I actually did some reading in that. I mean, my first jumping off point with Advent as the title of the book was, you know, it's putting the Advent back into Adventist.
Yep, cool.
And of course, we focus, you know, the tradition in our faith community has been focused on the second Advent.
Yeah.
But the Advent in Adventist should be at least as much focused on the first Advent. You know, we are Jesus people, and that's what we should be about. That's the best story we've got to tell. And then, but then there is this other Christian tradition of these 4 weeks that are a period of expectation and anticipation of what will come. And so I did some reading about that and some of the traditional Christian calendar kind of uses of that. And I actually discovered that my thinking about it was not unique, which is something that many of us discover when you actually go and do some research in something. That this was not just focused on that the season of Advent was also a time of basically expecting God to act in the world. Now, we've seen that in the story of Jesus, and we never do Advent as without the understanding that Jesus has already come. We can't pretend he hasn't. So while we are building up to telling that story again, we're also living in the recognition that this is a focus on that God will act in the world today and that God will act again in the world in the future. And so even in the traditional liturgical calendar, the Sunday after Christmas is actually called Christ the King Sunday. And so that's focused on, you know, God coming as king. You know, he's come as a child, he's come as a human being. Now he comes back as king to judge the world and to set wrongs right and to finish the story that began with the birth of Jesus 2,000 odd years ago. So while I think what I've done is very Adventist in the way we've looked at it, it also does fit with what has been the best of the Christian tradition in the past around this season in the church calendar.
You know what I love about that is, and forgive me if I go on a rant here.
Brace yourselves, everyone.
Here we go.
When you think about Adventists, what liturgy do we really have apart from the quarterly Sabbath school? Like, we don't really have much in the way of liturgy. And I think our early church fathers were pretty intentional about that. Our early church fathers and mothers, you know, they didn't want that sort of, I don't know, maybe they thought liturgy was Catholic or something like that. But the truth is that liturgy is found in so many denominations outside of Catholicism. And even if it is Catholic, then, okay, in my opinion, who really cares? Like, it's just because something, salvation is also Catholic, you know, Jesus is also Catholic. You can make anything Catholic if you want to. I think, though, the fact that we don't really have much of a liturgy, I think is so detrimental in so many different ways to us as a church, because I feel like what it does is it just gives us this free rein to kind of do whatever we want. And so many people just go, well, I don't know what I want to do, so I'm not going to do anything, you know. And I think you could definitely say that the church service is probably maybe the church service with the Sabbath school is probably our highest form of liturgy. It's sort of like the baseline level of, well, we expect you to rock up at a certain time to participate in a certain way, et cetera, et cetera. But beyond that, I love this idea of bringing back this idea of Advent, which is such a deep, rich tradition in so many other different denominations, but making it in a way that is totally accessible to somebody who has no liturgical experience before. Was that too ranty? Was that too many opinions?
A friend of mine once made the comment, and he actually is a relatively senior church leader these days, that as Adventists, we have as many traditions as anybody else. Ours just don't mean anything. which I think is a bit of a serious criticism, because it's great that these kind of traditions, I think, have really a significant part that we do things, and whether it's a liturgical preaching calendar or whatever, we do things because it's time to do them, not because we would necessarily choose them. That's what Sabbath is, to use a really good Adventist example. You know, we keep Sabbath when the sun sets, not when we're ready.
Yeah.
You know, because we're never ready. Yeah. If we wait till we feel like Sabbath, there's always something else to do.
Yeah, but true.
Because it happens by an external, kind of arbitrary signifier, then it just comes to us as an act of grace in that sense. And I think the same with some of these seasons, that we stop each year, you know, and our society and our culture prompts us to stop each year and retell the story of Jesus. That's such a great thing.
Absolutely.
Because if it was up to us, we'd just be busy and we'd keep going along, and we might not get to it it might not be every 12 months. It might be every 18 months that we came back to it, or, So again, this idea of a season where we say, this is what we do simply because it is this season, is a really good, even you could call it a spiritual discipline in that sense.
Because I think we need
stop and tell it again.
We need that reminder of actually to practice our spirituality in a way that reminds us of what it means to be human and what it means to relate to the divine, and the way the divine actually interacts with us on a spiritual level. Yeah.
Yeah, and even if you go back to the story of Christmas or the story of the birth of Jesus, which I've really focused the book on the story of the birth of Jesus rather than the story of Christmas, and I've been careful in my language there, because Christmas is kind of just an excuse to retell the story of Jesus, and the story of the birth of Jesus is the preeminent element of it. So that's where we need our focus to be rather than Christmas. But if Christmas prompts us towards that, that's great. But even in the retelling in the Bible, there's kind of this, the time had come for this to happen. Mm-hmm. It wasn't necessarily that, and when it did happen, most of the world didn't even notice. It's only kind of in the Christmas carols that the whole world holds its breath in this moment of expectation. That wasn't the story. The world was going on. But this thing happened that those who were alert to it noticed and said, there's something really amazing going on here. And this was the best part of my experience in putting the book together, was simply to go and read those stories more closely than I ever had before, and just to tease out some of the details of the rather scant Bible stories that we have that retell the story. But just some of those tiny little details of the rest of the world's going on, but for those people that actually noticed, those people that were looking for it, they recognized this as the most incredible thing that they'd ever come across. That, the stories of, the song of that Mary sings when she goes to visit Elizabeth in Luke chapter 1, there's these two peasant women in this tiny little village, that we don't even know the name of the village, somewhere in the hills of Judea, one so old as to be beyond any reasonable expectation of having a kid, the other someone who shouldn't have been pregnant and it was a scandal that she was, and they sing this song about how their two boys are going to change the world. It's just ridiculous, except the fact that we know they sang that song proves the significance of their boys and what they're about. And, there's no reason we would ever have known those places, those names, those stories, except that something really significant happened. And that's where to me, the ultimate picture of incarnation, Christmas, for all the junk that is associated with it and heaped on top of it, and all the layers of culture and sentimentality and all those things, the fact that this story still resides there at the heart of it, is the ultimate incarnation. Something of eternal value and significance and world-altering whatever, that kind of just buries itself amidst all this cultural nonsense. That is Christmas, and that is what incarnation is about. A lot of people, and it's one of these things that gets brought up all the time, that that Christmas is, you know, a pagan festival or whatever. And that's actually been largely rejected by many historians these days, that actually that's a cheap shot and it probably doesn't add up. But the picture of a pagan festival becoming, even if that was the case, a pagan festival being then adapted to Christian purposes, that's far less of an outrage than God becoming human. Because God becoming human is ridiculous, it's blasphemous, it's nuts, except it happened. And then that's the central miracle that is the story in the story of our world.
Wow. Yeah, you know, when you actually compare them, it seems pretty ridiculous. I don't think I've ever actually thought that through.
No.
Yeah. Wow. I think just the chaos we see around Christmas, I think amplifies people's issues with it even more, because even if they don't necessarily fall into the "it's pagan, so we shouldn't do anything about it" camp, the other side is it's just a consumeristic.
Yeah, it's still very easy to be cynical.
Yeah, yeah. For people it is an easy time of year to be cynical, especially if you've had a negative experience around Christmas and then it starts to carry in to every other year.
Yeah. And I guess my pushback on that is to say, yes, it is easy to be cynical, but we're not called to do the easy things. And the best act of resistance we can do to, whether it's the paganism or the so-called paganism, my air quotes won't work so well in an audio format, but, the paganism or the consumerism or the commercialism or whatever else you might object to Christmas, that's the easy thing to do, is to be critical of that. The hard thing, and perhaps the most significant act of resistance, is to step up and say, no, I celebrate Jesus. You know, that's what it's about. That's the core of it. I quote a funny little story from C.S. Lewis in the book, where he was talking about how, and he was talking from his Church of England perspective about the Feast of Nativity, as comparing that to the secular Christmas. And he told a story of a woman on a bus that he, I think his brother heard, overheard, and they were driving past a church, and this woman sees this nativity scene out the front of the church, and she goes, "Oh, they're trying to drag religion into everything these days, even dragging it into Christmas." And that's kind of a humorous example, but a true example of the ignorance that surrounds this. Yeah. And so there's almost a blank slate when it comes to the opportunity we have to reclaim the story of the birth of Jesus in this context. We can say, you know, this is the story that matters. You know, all the other stuff, yeah, there's lots of good things around Christmas. And because we don't have Thanksgiving in our part of the world, often Christmas becomes that kind of double thing where families get together and where, you actually look back over the year and are grateful for the good things that you've done. And, you know, you catch up and you spend time in that kind of way and you have good food and all those kind of things. And that's just wonderful. You know, there's so many good things about that. But this bigger picture of there's a story at the center of it that actually, if we just give it the chance, changes everything.
I'm wondering, 2020, if you'd written this book in another year, do you think it would be different than writing it in the context of the year that's been? Do you think that it's different by what's happened this year? Or do you think it would have been the same book had you written it 2019 or 2018 or 2017?
That's an interesting question. It certainly was easy to... It was one of those good things that redeemed my experience of lockdown. and I can look at that and say, hey, this is something that really not just was a good outcome of it, but actually helped me respond to the difficult times that, you know, we were all going through and as a community we were going through. So that's one aspect of it. It helped to get done in a hurry because there was a few less distractions. Yeah. But I think there might be an extra sense of urgency to it, as in, and I don't mean that necessarily in a, you know, an apocalyptic sense or something like that, but simply that amidst all the things that have gone on this year and all the headlines and all the things, you know, all the craziness. And by craziness, I don't mean the things that, just the things that have happened, but some of the things that everybody's been speculating about happening and all the conspiracy theories that have, you know, filled up too much of the time of our churches and the thinking of people that should know better. That this is actually the most important story we have to tell. You know, I was disappointed with some parts of the church that our first impulse when, you know, a significant thing like a pandemic started to happen across the world, that our first impulse was to reach for the book of Revelation rather than the stories of Jesus. Because the book of Revelation, well, firstly, there's nothing about pandemics in it. That's the short version.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people that have rushed to that, if they're honest with it, will be disappointed. But when you go to the story of Jesus, that is actually the thing that says this is how you live well in difficult times. This is, you know, the basics of what Jesus taught about how to care for others, about how to not be afraid, but trust in God, you know, trust him for your, you know, that he'll provide the things you need for your lives, trust him that he's in charge of the future, that he's got, you know, that he's active in our world, expecting him to work. You know, again, that anticipation of Advent is to expect God to act. That's the reality that we should, that should be our first impulse when we're faced with tough times, whatever they may be. And so I've, even more so than when I was writing the book, but over the last few weeks as I've been reflecting on, you know, reflecting on the year, but reflecting on some of the, you know, whether it's politics or pandemics or whatever else might be in that space, that have got, that has grabbed our attention and said, you know, this is the most important thing that's happening. I think that, again, it's an act of resistance to come back and say, the most important thing I've got to say is to retell the story of Jesus. And that's the most important thing that our church has to share. And I've been so gratified that, you know, this book has been taken on by churches across Australia and New Zealand to, you know, and I've had churches, stories of churches that have given copies to every family in their church and that are sharing it in their communities and giving it out to their friends and neighbours as Christmas gifts.
Awesome.
And that's just, you know, because I truly believe, and this is, you know, this would be the kind of thing that I'd be excited that our church was sharing, you know, even if I had nothing to do with it, because this is what, this is the best thing we've got to say. And this is the most meaningful and world-changing thing that we've got to say, whatever the circumstances. But I think in difficult circumstances, to simply insist on retelling the story of Jesus is the best thing we can do.
Yeah. I feel like this year, more so than ever, we need to lean into that rather than lean into our classic cynical selves, you know, around I don't know, we see it all over our denomination, but maybe this year can be the year that we just say, look, let's just put all that aside and let's come back to that story that we need to tell. And we need to tell afresh, you know, like tell it in a way that makes sense to a current generation, like tell it in a way that makes sense to a 2020 person. Yeah, which is kind of easier said than done sometimes, but
I you know, Adventists are very stuck in their ways. So, man, it's funny as you were talking about how we're more used to reaching for the book of Revelation than we are for the book of Matthew, Luke, Mark, and John. I couldn't help but think of my own local context of, you know, some of my colleagues, and not to, you know, no indictment upon any of my colleagues who are currently ministering to their churches and all that sort of stuff, but I think we've got a long way to go before we can get to that place that you're talking about, Nathan. And as you're talking about it, I'm like, yes, this is exactly what we need to be doing, because it's so much easier to just reach for the classics than it is to... Because telling the story of Jesus, as you say, it's not just about telling the story of Jesus, it's about inserting ourselves into the way of Jesus. And... seeing ourselves in that place.
Yeah, one of the things that's surprised me, to be honest, about how the church has responded, particularly to the pandemic across this year, but also to some of the other things, is how much effort we've put into doing the same things we've done all along.
Just harder, just going harder, you know?
Yeah, or even we think we're being innovative just because we're doing it online. You know, I think, you know, it was a great novelty to be on a Zoom meeting, and then everybody got sick of it very, very quickly.
Yep.
And the reality is that, you know, it's like the future where they always said we'd have video phones and all of a sudden we do. And, you know, it's like out of the Jetsons. But I haven't seen real innovation in our thought, in our spirituality, in our engagement with our communities in creative ways. Now, that's a horrible generalization, and there have been good examples. But, you know, I know that some of the major initiatives in the midst of lockdowns in our part of the world was running public evangelism crusades, and I use that word advisedly, online. And that was innovation, even though they were the same sermons everybody's been preaching for the last, you know, 50 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course we tack a little bit of current events onto it to make it seem that it's rich from the headlines. But it's just, that's not creativity and that's not innovation. And so what we need to do is find ways that will actually engage with people and that people will respond to in ways that actually matter and ways that aren't just fear.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real problem for those that seek to peddle fear, but also those that try and cash in on fear. To me, the most blatant choice to make in how you live in the world is love or fear.
Mm.
And too much of the time the church peddles, well, even if the church isn't creating fear, we're happy to trade in it.
Mm.
And
we're just dipping our toes into the pool a little bit because here's what I've always thought. We are kind of addicted to doing that because it still works to a certain degree. Like,
yeah.
You're going to run an evangelistic campaign, you're going to spend $50,000 and you might baptize 10 people, but you still baptize 10 people and they might already come preloaded with some pretty intense conspiracy theory leanings, but that's okay because we baptized 10 people.
And who can put a price on us all, brother?
That's exactly right. apparently $5,000 per person is the price.
Is a reasonable return.
Right? But I don't think that we are brave enough yet to fully embrace what you're saying because I think what we've been doing has been working, even though it hasn't been working well, I think it still works. But it just the ROI is so low.
And the other thing that I think is fascinating here is if you talk about the science of values priming, which to me is a fascinating thing about basically the thing that you use to convince people to do something affects the outcome, affects the quality of what you produce. And so, yes, you might get a result by using a certain approach, but that doesn't mean you'll get a result that is the best result that you can get. So, you know, if you motivate somebody to do something good by fear, it's not as good an outcome as if you motivate somebody or if you invite somebody to do something that's good for a good reason.
Mm.
You know, if you provoke them to by beauty or by goodness or by truth or justice or peace or whatever it might be, then everybody is better as a result of that.
Mm.
And, yeah, I sat in a workshop a few years ago at an activism conference and, a whole session on this values priming stuff, and I was just blown away about, you know, what this means evangelistically, politically, culturally, and just that the ends don't justify the means because the means matter and the means mean that the end is different, even if you think that you're achieving something. And that's, you know, I think we as a church really need to spend some time thinking on that, is how do we provoke people to good, you know, by presenting the things that are good.
Yeah.
And even by overcoming evil by good, as Romans 12:20 puts it. That's who we're called to be.
Yeah. And I think it's the harder road to walk, you know, because I think, you know, even as Jesus was on the road to Jerusalem, as he was heading towards his own execution, he was still leaning into that. And as people of Jesus walking through dark times, it's very easy for us to be the moaners and the groaners about how terrible things are, and the predictors of how much more terrible things are going to be. But yet it does strike me that as Jesus was walking to the cross, he was still encouraging. He was still healing. He was still preaching. He was still teaching. He was still empathizing. He was doing all the things that are just espoused by his character. And so, yeah, that just makes me think of the way that we walk in this dark world as people of hope rather than people of pain and over-prediction.
And I think the other thing, the most significant prophetic, faithful statement we can make in the world is simply, it doesn't have to be this way. You know, to me, that's drawing on the best of the Hebrew prophets. You know, they predicted gloom and doom a lot of the time, and judgments and harsh, really harsh stuff against the idolatry and injustice that the people were doing. But almost always their message came back, it doesn't have to be this way. And I think that's the most profound thing we can say in the world today. When we confront injustice, you know, and this year, the other thing that a lot of people have spent some time on has been, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests and some of these things. You know, the statement that we can make as faithful people of God in the world in this thing is a recognizing the history of racism and how that has developed, and to simply say it doesn't have to be this way. People made choices that got us to this point. That means we can make different choices.
Yeah.
And I would say that so much of Bible prophecy, which we then try and tie up into a history of the future, is actually, it doesn't have to be this way. You know, this is the inevitable outcome of continuing to make these choices. The people of God are the ones that choose differently, and that choose to live differently, choose to live with hope, who choose to live by faith, that choose to live in light of the story of Jesus, and that choose to live in community and in empathy and compassion for other people. And thus the world is different. You know, that's who we're called to be.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it comes back to the whole being not transformed by the world around you, but actually transforming the world around you for the sake of Christ. Like it's a mindset shift, and not just being caught in the tide or in the rip, but actually.
And also in the sense that we reject the sense of inevitability that is thrust upon us.
Mm.
You know, people in power always want to tell you that it's inevitable that they're in power. And people, you know, and the evil in our world, one of the ways that it is perpetuated is simply by this kind of, you know, tacit acceptance that it's just the way the world is. And so our call as people of God is that we get this alternative vision of what the world was intended to be, what the world will be, which changes how the world is now. And thus, in the light of that, we're called to live and to serve and to speak.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think that sense of inevitability, that's not even really a core value of Adventism, especially when you come down to the whole like Calvinism versus Arminianism thing. Like,
yeah.
We're huge on freedom of choice, and the whole great controversy is that there's this battle raging, and you have to choose who you're going to serve.
That's right.
Man, I can't believe I jumped into the great controversy from that. That is so not a normal thing for me to do. But it's so like, that's exactly where we are. Like, we're not supposed to have that just. Yeah, sense of
the fatalistic.
I'm really just linking this right now. Yeah, fatalistic. That's not us.
Beautiful. I like seeing those connections made.
Yeah.
No, thanks, David. You're exactly right. And I think that's if our freedom of choice matters, then that means that we choose things every day that change how the world is. And you know that we are a part of shaping the world. You know, we may not have massive influence, but we do all have voice and influence of some kind. And that makes a difference, that our world must be better because we are here as people of God. And that and there are people in the world that desperately need the world to be better.
Mm. So true. I had a question about how to use the book. So,
a book. We keep losing sight of this. I'm supposed to be the author that keeps plugging the book. But I'm not very good at this, am I?
I love these rabbit holes. It's great. It's great. No, so obviously you can read this as a devotional. You can read it with a partner or with your kids. How are you seeing the book being used? How would you suggest the book be used apart from the, I guess, the obvious applications?
Yeah, so the simple thing is, firstly, that I think I hope and I expect that it will be something that, people can make part of their Christmas experience. You know, where many of us are used to the Advent calendars that, you know, with a chocolate a day to count down the days to Christmas.
I must say I was very disappointed that there was not a chocolate included with every chapter. I was kind of expecting that. But
I was
going to
put a QR code and you could scan and download a chocolate. that's the first thing. And, you can buy yourself a chocolate a day if you wish, Jesse.
Okay, thank you. That's a good idea.
The invitation is there.
At the end of the chapter.
Yeah, right. Finish the chapter.
It'll make the experience all the sweeter. Sorry, that's a bad joke.
Thanks, Dad.
Great.
But one of the things that was the vision for this project is that because we've talked about it in the way that we have, that it's something that I've tried definitely to write so it's accessible. And so you don't have to be a lifelong churcher to get it. You may just be curious about, so why do we stop every year and think about this story to some degree or another? And so the book opens with an invitation to say, if you've never heard this story before, you know, here's a couple of Bible bits you can read just to get you into it. And then, you know, just give us a chance to think about, you know, why this matters if it's true. And, you know, what are some of the implications of some of the claims that are made about it? Because the claims that are made about it in the story itself are just incredible. You know, they are so remarkable that, you know, they probably deserve at least a little hearing. Mm-hmm. So that's the invitation. And we designed it prettily, you know, that it looks like a premium gift.
It looks great. Yeah,
beautiful.
Honestly, it really
gold
looks
foiling
nice
on the cover.
It's amazing. I feel so bougie just having it in my collection.
That's it. So the idea is that if you have a neighbor, a friend, a family member, someone, you know, even a community leader, you know, and a pastor in another church, your local mayor, you know, whatever that you want to just give a gift to at this time, you know, and Christmas is the time when we do those things, then, you know, that it's designed to be a book that will be accepted in that way. And every part of what we did in packaging it in that way is to make it look premium, to make it look like somebody cared. It's even on thicker paper than most of the books that we publish, just to make it feel a bit classier. We got an endorsement from Tim Costello, who was a prominent Christian, but public Christian leader here in Australia, with a view to, that's a name that when somebody picks up the book or they unwrap it, then when you've given it to them as a Christmas gift, they go, oh, I know who he is. I've seen him on the news. I might have a look. And Tim was very generous in supporting the project by that way. So the idea is that, and often as a church we've done, you know, focused on mass sharing of, you know, let's letterbox every town with a copy of, you know, every house in town with a copy of this book or this tract or whatever. But my vision for what people would do with this would be meaningful sharing. You know, sharing that is in the context of a relationship, that where you're making a commitment to being there to have a conversation with the person once they've had a look at it in a few weeks' time, or, you know, that kind of thing where it's in the context of a relationship, so it actually matters rather than just being junk mail. And that, I think, is, again, comes back to it. Actually, the idea of the book is that it looks like somebody cares about what it says, that it's valuable and that it's the kind of thing that because somebody else took it seriously, you might take it seriously too. So even in its presentation, we've been very intentional in making it look like it matters.
That's very cool. So can churches use it? Do you reckon, was there some intentionality for faith communities to do collective sharing together with it?
Yeah, and so I've come across a few churches that have given out copies to every family in their church, and then have extra copies so that once those families have had the chance to have a look through it and get to know it a little bit, that they will then, you know, here's some extra copies if you want to give one to your neighbour or your, you know, your school teacher, you know, your kid's school teacher or whatever it might be. You know, there's so churches are using it in that way. And then planning to work through it across the month of December so that every church, every family in the church has that book, they're working through it, they're discovering it in together. Also, there's a few churches around Australia that I'm aware of that are planning Christmas, you know, public Christmas programs, you know, whether it's a worship service, and they're using the branding from the book, you know, so the title and some of those kind of things for their, you know, social media images or their advertising or whatever. And connecting it to the book. And so if you come along, we'll give you a copy of the book as a Christmas gift. And I believe the Warunga Church in Sydney is planning a big Christmas carol-y kind of program, and it's going to be themed or going to use this as an aspect of it as well. So quite a variety of things. And, pretty excited to have it used in that way. It's, again, as I said earlier, it's... the kind of thing that I'd be excited to see our church printing, whether I had anything to do with it or not. But also just, you know, it's a privilege to be, you know, something that you've labored over in such a personal kind of way, but then to see, you know, thousands of church members, you know, heaps of churches getting involved with, getting excited about it. That's pretty cool.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, just, yeah, you did touch on it, but the language on it, I was really impressed at how, because I always keep a very big eye out for like any media that uses too much sort of Adventese, you know, it's just like all this Adventist language and you'd only get it if you're an Adventist. But I found the language in this book, like anybody could get it. And I think that's awesome. So I think it would make a good like gift. And I was actually thinking about people that I would share it with and they would just get it, you know, like it's not, I wouldn't even say it uses Christianese really. Like it's really... Yeah, really open language, which is really cool to see, because often our media does not do that. So, yeah.
Again, that's very intentional and that's what we tried to make it. And I mean, to me, one of the most gratifying things was my wife, who's not somebody who's your average literature sharing church member in that traditional kind of sense. Yep. She told me she wants a couple of copies to give to a couple of her friends. And cool. I was just, wow. I actually said, oh, wow, that kind of took me by surprise. But she said, because it's good. And, you know, it's, you know, it is accessible to those people and I care about them and I think that this is a good thing. Yeah, and so sometimes your greatest gratifications are closer to home in that sense. And, you know, it's nice that people out there are using it, but the fact that my wife believes in it, that's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, when the spouse is all in, you're like, yeah, this is definitely actually good.
Like, that's right.
It's awesome.
So good. Hey,
so one of the other great things that's happening with it, sorry, Jesse.
No, you go.
One of the other great things that's happening with it this year is... with all the COVID restrictions and some of those kind of things, we haven't been able to do the Road to Bethlehem thing here in Melbourne in the way that we traditionally have done. Road to Bethlehem has been, over the past 25 years, a sort of walk-through nativity play, immersion experience in the story of Jesus' birth. It's been just one of the best things that our churches have done here in Melbourne over that 25 years has traditionally attracted tens of thousands of people through it each year, you know, in groups, you know, large groups coming through and just walking through different scenes of the story. And it's something that I've had the privilege to be a part of over the past 7 years. I think I worked out Wise man number three.
really the key wise man to the story, which some would say.
I think it's probably almost the pivotal role of the entire story.
Yeah, definitely.
Because they do have some of the best lines about, you know, the prophecies that pointed them to this baby and what it actually means and why it matters. Yeah, so that's just my little plug for the significance of wise menning. yeah. But it is an acting role because I have to act wise. But this year, we're doing it as a we've filmed it, and it will be as on the 13th of December will be a premiere online experience, and that's been something that to me has actually been a spark of my growing appreciation of the story over the past few years, which has contributed to the book, and I think I even referenced my experience as a wise man in one of the chapters in the book. But just to be immersed in the story in a unique way, to work with a team of people that are just so passionate about telling the story each year, but also to see the thousands of people coming through and responding to it, being captivated by it and being open to it. And so this year, as I said, we've filmed it. You can register so that you can be part of the premiere at roadtobethlehem.org. And that's available from anywhere in the world, of course. I think there's very few Road to Bethlehems that are happening because of the COVID challenges and restrictions and some of these kind of things. And so this is the replacement event for it. A cameo once again as Wise Man 3. I'm not sure about my screen acting debut. I'm a little nervous about that one.
He writes, he acts. What else does he do? My goodness.
But even here... in Victoria, for people that register, they're giving away the book as a gift, and limited to the people in Victoria. But if you sign up to register, you become part of this event. And so far, the registrations have been open for a couple of weeks, and we've sent out 400 copies of the book.
Awesome.
Which is just great, and they are people from who knows where that are responding to the story, that are interested. Most of them, of course, have probably seen it in the past, but this is an opportunity to go deeper with it. So I invite you to come along and be part of Road to Bethlehem in this unique way this year, and register as soon as you can and be part of the fun. But, yeah, again, just another significant way of retelling the story.
Yeah, very awesome. Cool. Well, get on it, guys. We all love free stuff. It's free up. For those of you in Victoria, our listeners down there, I know there's a good chunk of you down there, so stay strong in lockdown and enjoy Road to Bethlehem, and maybe, just maybe, you'll get a free book.
But so this is also great for people in New Zealand as well, because we usually have a great Road to Bethlehem in Tauranga, but that's unfortunately been cancelled this year. So if you are listening from New Zealand or Ethiopia or United States or anywhere
Arizona?
Else in the world.
I don't know if we have any listeners in Arizona. I just felt like saying it.
Where's
if
my you're Arizona?
If you're listening in Bethlehem, you can tune in to see what Bethlehem's really like.
This is the real deal, folks. None of that fake Bethlehem nonsense.
Yeah, that's right. You were mentioning KFC before. Bethlehem has a KFC.
Oh,
really?
You know what?
Now I want to go.
I want to go to Bethlehem just for the KFC.
See, it's a Christmas town.
That's where the Christmas tradition comes from.
It's always Christmas. It's just one of those things that you've never thought of before.
Yeah.
Is that Bethlehem is a KFC.
Did you mention that? Right. I feel like you may have mentioned that when we were interviewing
you last time. Yeah, with the falafels book. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah,
I also did draw on a little bit of those experiences of visiting, particularly Bethlehem, in this book. Just some of the reflections that you get while visiting the town where it's always Christmas. But that is just such, except for the fact that this happened there, is so inconsequential a place. It is just that ordinary kind of town. And I think, well, again, we see the miracle of that incarnation is that it happened in a specific time and a specific place. It's not just a story, it's history. But that happened in an unremarkable place in so many ways.
And compared that to Albert Einstein's birthplace. Which he only spent, a year there before he moved on. But it's where he's from.
That's right, yeah. And I think that's a fascinating yeah, the fact that we give significance to the birthplace of someone, even when it may have very little influence in who or what they are or became. Mm. So really it's a reflection back on who that, you know, we give significance to the place because of who the person was, not the place doesn't give significance to the the person. Yeah. So yeah, it's a I am fascinated by that idea of why we would visit the birthplace of Albert Einstein, for example, which I did by accident because I was going to try see the biggest, the tallest church in the world. So
there you go.
In the same town.
What a coincidence. So do you guys think Mary and Joseph stopped at KFC on the way through or on the way out, maybe while they were there, you know, travelling through? Where else are you going to stop, right?
This is the part where the podcast goes downhill.
Yeah, probably a good place to do a U-turn. Let's head out of here.
Turn the donkey around.
Turn that donkey around, everyone. All right. Awesome. No, well, thank you so much, Nathan. We really appreciate it. Anything else you want to add about the book before we wrap up?
Yeah, so we've talked about churches sharing it and all those kind of things, but the simplest thing is to buy yourself a copy, available from almost any book retailers. If you're listening internationally, the best and cheapest and easiest place to get it is either bookdepository.com. Just look for Advent Nathan Brown. There's lots of books if you look up Advent. There's lots of books if you look up Nathan Brown. Because there's lots of other Nathan Browns in the world that have written books. But if you do Advent Nathan Brown, you'll find it. And, of course, the beauty of Book Depository is that they include the free postage to anywhere in the world. So that's a pretty good deal. If you want the ebook, it's available on Amazon for Kindle or available in Australia and New Zealand from an Adventist bookstore near you or most other book retailers. So it's on most of the book-selling web stores. So grab yourself a copy, buy one for everyone you know for Christmas, because it's all your Christmas shopping needs solved in this moment. If you just get a box full of books, everybody gets a book. It's really, really simple, and books are always easy to wrap. Yeah, so that it just ticks so many boxes, and you're sharing something good and meaningful and all those things at the same time.
Yeah, you could be like Oprah. You get a book. You get a book. Everyone gets a book.
Although I would say if you are planning to buy this as a Christmas present, maybe it might not be a bad idea to give the person on December 1 as an early Christmas present so they can experience it all. I don't know. That's pretty controversial.
I recommended that. I mean, you don't have to read it one chapter a day. You can read it all in a day if you get that excited about it.
True.
So, you know, that's just one way to use it. The risk of giving someone a present on December 1 is that they've forgotten about it by Christmas and expect something else.
You know? That's true. That's dangerous.
So you've got to watch out for your shifty friends and relatives that then will try and double dip on the Christmas giving.
But you would look super organised. That's a
you
pro.
You would, indeed. Yeah. And I've even had some people suggest that they're going to send them instead of Christmas cards this year.
Oh, that's cool.
You can just write a happy Christmas greeting in the front of the book and, you know, it's relatively... relatively postable, and yeah, there's a simple way of sharing something good for Christmas. So yeah,
and
you're only limited by your imagination.
And if people want to check out some of the other books that you've written, would they be better off going to Book Depository or the Science website? What would be the best course of action if they want to check out some of your other books?
Yeah, I have an author page on Amazon. So if you find Advent there and then click on the Nathan Brown there, you'll get the list of all the other things that are available there. If you go to one of the Adventist Book Center web stores in different parts of the world, you'll find a few different titles there. Technically, I think this is my 17th book with my name on the front of it.
Wow.
So there's a little bit of a back catalogue that's starting to grow, and that makes me feel old and you know, all those things. But
should make you feel accomplished, man.
It's
cool.
It's a nice shelf on my bookshelf at home, my books. That's a fun kind of thing, and it's fun to look back on. The other thing with this book is that this now gets me to 100,000 books in print.
Wow.
So total print runs across all of those. So That was a little bit of a milestone that I was kind of, that's kind of cool.
Congratulations.
Really cool.
Yeah.
And most of that is just, I see it as a privilege and, you know, it's more a privilege than an opportunity. that I've just had all these incredible, you know, opportunities. I think I said more a privilege than an opportunity, more a privilege than an achievement.
Right.
That makes more sense. So it's more a privilege than an achievement. I've just had some incredible opportunities over the years, and you just keep trying to do the next best thing. As those opportunities come along, and the biggest thing is where people pick up something and go, you know, that really helped or encouraged me, or that made me think about something different, or, you know, that's the real privilege, even a step more, is that, you know, people take it seriously and engage with it, and, you know, they buy one for somebody else, and, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing for someone to commit a little bit of themselves in saying, I recommend this to you, and, you know, I think this could be helpful or encouraging or whatever it might be. So, yeah, I think, again, you know, 2020, it's been a year.
It has.
We get invited back to the core of what it's actually about when we simply stop and recognize Jesus. And that's really what this is an invitation to.
So good.
Really good. Great place to land the plane. Hey, we'd love to hear what you think, everybody. So send us your thoughts and questions. We'd love to hear it all. And of course, the best place to find all things Burn the Haystack is burnthehaystack.org. That's where you go. It's links to all our social and a way to contact us directly through there.
And if you haven't already, hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening or watching online. If you'd like to help us get this podcast out so we can have more awesome conversations with Nathan and many other beautiful people just like him, leave us a rating or a review on your podcatching app of choice. And if you would like to help us out even more, you can even buy some merch on our website. So that's also on burnthehaystack.org. Buy yourself a t-shirt, get Nathan's book, wrap the book in the t-shirt. Use
that
the
would
t-shirt.
Be the ultimate Christmas gift, wouldn't
the
it?
The ultimate.
It really
could be. A copy of Advent wrapped in a Burn the Haystack t-shirt.
It's critically acclaimed gift, really.
Yes. So, be fantastic.
Yeah. In fact, you could make a whole Advent calendar out of them, and every day you just open a new shirt.
It's like the Christmas gift giving version, the Adventist Christmas gift giving version of the Tadakan. You know, the book inside the t-shirt inside
the jumper, inside the Isaac jumper. Obviously,
it's starting to sound as much of an abomination as a Tadakan.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much, Nathan, and thanks everyone for listening. Stay awesome. Stay beautiful. That is Josh, Jesse, and Nathan. Thank you.